The Conservation Committee will now turn the meeting over, back over to the Finance Committee to complete items still on his agenda.
Thank you, Commissioner Bevins. We will now take up committee item number two, the proposed stamp and print artwork program, migratory game bird, upland game bird, non-game, saltwater fish, and freshwater fish stamps. And the Spence Styles and Marvin Wood are going to make presentations.
For the record, my name is Frances Stiles. I'm with the Administrative Resources Division. Today we're here to do the presentation of the prints for this year under the terms of the contract for the print program. Mr. Wood brings the artwork down for review. We have those displayed. These are combined into a collector's stamp set, and both the stamps and the prints are offered for sale for purchase. So I'm going to turn this over to Mr. Wood to go through the prints that are available today.
Thank you, Francis. My name is Mark Boyd, for the record. Last year we paid the department $52,900 for the stamps and prints we sold. That $52,000 brought our total to over $7 million that we paid the department in the last 28 years. If you want to go over the art, I learned when we get down here in the regulations that we clearly have a problem. We featured the lesser prairie chicken in the upland bird, thinking that it needed as much attention as it could have, and that it was something we were going to hunt. And obviously we've taken the right turn, which I am totally in favor of, but you know, your all's decision would be in addition to accepting the art, would be what do we do? You know, I mean, we got a great piece of art. You know, I think it sends out it obviously calls attention to the bird chicken, but I don't see how we can possibly put a bird that we're not going to hunt this next season. Or I assume, I mean, I know that we just put out for comment, but by the time you get the comment and make the decision, when is it, in March that you do the regs, or when do you actually do the regs?
What, March.
You know, it's almost too late. To make the change, you know. I would assume, based on the status of the lesser prairie chicken, that we're not going to hunt next year, right? I mean,
more than likely.
So I guess what we have to do is to get a new piece of art of a different bird, and obviously our choices of what we haven't used since it's been the upland game bird, or a turkey, or a gamble's quail. You know, that pretty well covers the, we've done a blue quail, bob white, and a pheasant, and else. But anyway, and we'll take this art and try to find a fundraising cause or something to use it with, because it's a great piece of art by the preeminent duck stamp artist in the country, Jim Hoffman. I thought I was really doing good. Obviously, I didn't know what was going on.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
Why can't it still be used and us turn this fluke of timing into a positive by drawing attention to the fact that this bird is in trouble, and we're doing everything we can to help it, and blah, 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 blah.
What are rules and regulations? Are you doing any setup somehow as a fundraiser or some way to raise money for it?
Well, if you had this on the upland game stamp, some guy's going to shoot a prairie chicken and claim that he thought the image on the stamp
put
a Labrador up on it and really open up the season.
I think John's asking, is there some other way we can use it?
Well, I don't know. I get a fundraiser. At some point, the people that are...
So you could put it in an auction somehow,
this is not, I mean, it's an inconvenience to the artist, and he's going to be disappointed, but I mean, that's just, you know, this is just a drive-by shooting that no one could anticipate, you know. I'm tickled to death that you guys are suspending the season on them. I mean, you know.
That's the right thing.
I mean, this is just a piece of art. You look at from the prairie chicken side of the bet, you know. Anyway, if it's all right, I'll pick something else, and we can perhaps disseminate it to you by by email for y'all to approve?
Yeah, why don't you do it that way? You know, you're the expert on this, so let us know what you think is the most appropriate way. And it's an original, beautiful piece of art. Maybe there's a way then we can, you know, raise some money for an auction with it or something. Yeah, I'm living in the country or someplace. Living says they'll pay big money.
Well, if he'd commit now for $25,000, we could just make
it.
You might even attach, we can shoot one if you pay $25,000.
Oh, no. We'll get drunk.
Anyway, well, we'll come up with something different and I'll, I mean, the art's not a problem. I mean, that's not a problem.
Okay, fair enough.
Mr. Chairman, can I just make a suggestion? One Bubba makes a selection here as to what he thinks would be an appropriate substitution. It might be easiest if you want to just delegate that decision-making authority to me so that we can move ahead with that pretty expeditiously as opposed to wait to another meeting. So
I'll just send you, when the art's finished, I'll send you a digital image of it, tell you what it is.
Do we need to make the move and all that, or can we just...
Yes, you're going to need to formally delegate that.
Okay. So move to delegate to Ted Carter Smith to make a decision on changing, I guess, the
post.
Game stamp from one to another. Second, all in favor?
The first stamp on your pride is Blue Wing Teal by Scott Storm. He's a Minnesota artist. Won the Federal Duck Stamp in 2004, and this is the first year we've ever used Scott in his art.
Really?
We get lots of calls during the year, people wanting to know what the contest is, right, you know, to get part in the deal. You know, my first question is, have you ever entered a duck stamp contest? No, but, you know, I'd like to do the duck stamp. And, not, you know, sort of not every artist that has done our duck stamp has won the Federal Duck Stamp, but vast majority of them are the real prominent Texas artists that will bring their own market to the deal.
Right.
So, but Scott won in 2004, and he's a terrific artist. The next piece is the Freshwater. That's a white bass by John Dearman, and John Dearman has done 12 stamp prints over the 28 years we've been doing this. The next piece is by Tom Quinn, who's one of the most famous wildlife artists in the world. It's a Harris Hawk. That's what I found interesting. The guy this morning talking about flying his Harris Hawk.
Exactly.
About those buckworms to look at it and see what he thought of it. Tom Quinn shows at the Prix de West in Oklahoma City, at the American Master Show in Los Angeles at the Archery Museum, at the Lee Alkey Woodson Art Museum, Birds and Art Show, which is by far the most prestigious bird art show in the world. And he's really not a duck stamp artist, but he's a heck of an artist, and we needed something that she couldn't shoot. So he won. The saltwater is a cobia or ling. Don Ray has done two saltwater stamps for us, of a Dorado, a dolphin, and a blue marlin. And he's illustrated Saltwater Sportsman Field and Stream, International Game Fish Association World Record Book, Cabela's Catalogs, member of the Society of Animal Artists, and pretty much is a saltwater fish specialist, although he has done one freshwater print for us. He's from Barrel Beach, Florida. And that's our deal.
As always, you've done a tremendous job.
Thank you.
It might be interesting, we have some new, fairly new commissioners. A couple of years ago, you took us through how the amounts of dollars have changed so dramatically over the years,
right,
dropping. It might be interesting just for people to understand this. How much you used to sell versus what it sells for.
Right. The duck stamp started, at first there was only a duck stamp. It started in 1981. At the time we published that print, it was the largest signed in numbers limited edition print ever published of any kind, even larger than the Federal Duck Stamp prints. We paid the department that year $770,000 in royalties. The Texas Duck Stamp print, and because of the money it raised spawned to the next 25 state duck stamp grant programs, virtually none of which are even in business anymore. They went 2 or 3 years. And of course, they didn't have 22 million people in Texans and 80% of the birds in the Central Flyway. There were lots of things going in our favor. But we didn't have any idea what the ongoing impact was going to be. But the next year, everyone learned that on a nationwide basis, people collected the first of states, and they started really with the Texas. But the next year, our royalty, we paid y'all probably $400,000. The number I'm looking at here that Francis has is just the print revenue number. But the real revenue is the number of stamps also sold with those prints. And it continued to decline until the infamous 1995 when we automated the license system. And at that point, the stamp was no longer required. And everyone said, well, it's not collectible. Now, every other state that has automated their license system still requires a printed duck stamp. But frankly, that wasn't the way Andy wanted to do it. He had a bigger agenda, and certainly I wasn't going to stand in the way of a bigger agenda. What we didn't know was at that time, the real sales pitch was the mailing list that was going to be generated from all these license sales that'd be available to sell prints and other things too. They didn't think the person entering that information was going to be a Walmart employee. And of course, the mailing list absolutely works. And now I think it's prohibited by law to sell, because now it's in under the auspices of the Highway Patrol or something like that.
There is a statutory prohibition.
Yeah, prohibition. Yeah. Right. So, you know, our puppy died and everyone went on down the road. And you can see from the numbers, we went from $139,000 in royalty to $99,000 the next year, and then it just continued to decline. The good news is we get, the state of Texas has made times a factor of many, whatever any other state, may have made more than all the other states combined on their duck stamp rent program, because the commission set it up right and said to us as a winning bidder that, hey, do it any way you want to, just pay, you know, tell us how much royalty you're going to pay us, and that's what the bid was on. And it was bid for about 5 or 6 years. In the last 3 or 4 years, we were the only bidders, because everyone wanted the gravy of the first one, but didn't want to mess with it on an ongoing basis. And so, you know, you've inherited me by default. But the positive thing I could say is it's still $52,000 a year.
Yeah,
and I think I'm the only one showing up here today bringing a check as opposed to telling you it's $880,000, which you know you're not going to get to work on parts. Anyway, it's been a great relationship, and I really enjoyed it. And while it's not as near as big a part of our business as it used to be, it's still our identity. I mean, it's the thing I'm proudest of is the amount of money. I mean, the wonderful art that we've done. I mean, every great artist in the country has done Bob Kuhn, Ken Carlson. I mean, it's just remarkable. And still, guys want to do it. They know there's not much royalty money in it for them, but they want to do it because it's such a prestigious thing to be with Kuhn and Carlson, among others, and Jim Hoffman, I mean. Anyway, it's been a lot of fun.
Well, you've represented us well, and represented the state well, so I thank you for that, and I appreciate it, but I know it's serious.
And of course, the good news is, one thing I might ask you all, last year I requested, frankly, of Frances, if she could see if we could use our stamp print art on the Texas Hunting Digest. The reply I got back was, Texas Monthly doesn't want to do it. You know, that's the moral equivalent of you telling me you want a cinnamon teal on the duck stamp next year and me not doing it. I mean, you know, that's just not good business. I don't know why we can't use art, publicize the art. Orville Wright was a fabulous 1940 vintage illustrator. But he couldn't clean Bob Kuhn or Jim Hawkins' paintbrushes, and you get a royalty off of the art that we would put on there. And I don't think we're going to sell a lot of prints, but it just seemed crazy to perpetuate art that has been used on a Parks and Wildlife cover 50 years ago, rather than using this new art that we have every year. It won't make up for discontinuing the stamp, but it'll be a step, you know?
Any other questions?
What happens to the original?
Sometimes the artists have them sold, sometimes we sell them, and believe it or not, sometimes they just don't sell.
But the artist has the original. I mean, if we sold the art, we would pay the artist the same commission, or he would pay us the same commission that he normally does. Our commission is a third. You know, that's. But a lot of times the artist will say, "I want to," you know, they've maintained the ownership of the original, that they have had it sold, or they, you know, if you might have a new artist, Scott Starr, he hasn't said, but he might say, you know, I don't want to sell any of my art. I want to keep all my dubstep art. I just want to keep it for my kids or something. Mm-hmm. It just goes back to them.
As an addition, under the contract, Mr. Wood gives us conservation prints that we can provide for conservation activities.
Hundreds of artist prints, or actually conservation editions that the department gives to Ducks Unlimited and, you know, anybody, you know, they can't give them all away. Put it this way. I mean, I'm sure you've got a closet. Got a lot of prints in here, I would think.
We do have a few.
But that's the deal.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
I appreciate you waiting for having me on.
We have a deal that maybe next year I could be first on the agenda.
Yes, we will.
Please, you know, 3.5 hours down, 5 hours waiting just for lunch, and then come back. You know, that I know on occasion I'm critical of something the department's doing, but, you know, that's cruel and unusual. You know, at least
I was not feeling that you didn't enjoy all 4.5 hours sitting there listening to all of this.
Y'all did great. I could not off. You know, I was caught up in the job. But one of you all did too.
Yes, sir.
Let me ask you a question on, say, for instance, the migratory game bird stamp. When we originally, and I say we because this was, what year did we do that?
1981.
Ducks Unlimited was going boom, 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 across the state. And,
John, let me tell them the history of that. The duck stamp legislation got passed. It was introduced by whoever the head of Ducks Unlimited was that year for the state of Texas. And John Wilson, who was a senator from LaGrange, carried the legislation, and the way the bill was written was that 50% of all the revenues generated from the stamp and the prints, well, they didn't even mention prints because they didn't know anything about it. They didn't even know about the possibility of the print, would go to Ducks Unlimited. And I went to Perry Bass, who was the chairman, and I said, "Mr. Bass, this is crazy. Texas, you know, at that time, Ducks Unlimited had singleness of purpose, which meant every penny they sold, they spent it in Canada. Yeah. You know, because that's where the ducks nested, and also because it wasn't a political football, if it all went to Canada. You know, Minnesota wasn't fighting with Texas or California about who got the money." And Perry Bass and Gib Bush turned that bill around and redrafted the bill where the department got all the money, and then the money stayed here. You know, because this money was originally qualified for Pittman Robinson and Dingle Johnson matching funds. I understand now that, so it's a multiple effect. But I understand now for the last 20 years that we've been maxed out on Dingle Johnson and Pittman Robinson money anyway, so it really doesn't now. But back then, it really brought, you know, millions of dollars in addition to what we
did. I'll be on.
So my question was, the migratory game bird stamp may be used according to Texas law, may be used only for management and research concerning migratory game birds, acquisition, lease, or development of migratory game bird habitats, contracts, donations, and grants, and all that is under section 43.659. My question is, what acquisition, lease, or development of migratory game bird habitats have we made in the last 6 years, or the last 12 years?
I can't answer that question in terms of the use of those funds, those duck stamp funds, to acquire migratory waterfowl habitat. Scott, can you, or can we get back to you with an answer on that? I just don't know, Commissioner. It's a good question. Can anybody answer it here?
I don't think we want to venture it, yes.
Okay. Could we get you an answer on that?
Yeah, I think I already know, but go ahead and you can give me an answer.
Okay. If there are no further questions or comments, I will place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. And in the interest of time, we will hear item number three tomorrow.
Yes.
Thank you. So we will hear item number three tomorrow. And we'll take up committee item number four, a briefing on recently concluded and ongoing internal audit activities and reports, and request approval of the fiscal year 2009 internal audit plan. And Carlos Contreras is going to make the presentation.
Hello. Good afternoon, Chairman, Commission members, and Mr. Smith. Thanks for the opportunity to provide you an update on the activities of the Office of Internal Audit. During our last meeting, we were requested to restructure our reporting mechanism so that we could actually, instead of having straight compliance audits, what we needed to do was do a risk ranking of the severity of the findings that we found. Subsequent to the meeting, we met with State Parks and Executive Management to develop a scoring mechanism for the noncompliance issues. And the severity of the noncompliance issues is based on a ranking from the findings that are brought forth from the individual audits. And then another component is the risk ranking associated with the revenue for the year, and that is a function of the revenue and the visitation for that time. We worked with State Parks and came to an agreement on the proposal that we had provided for the risk ranking component for our reporting. And during the process now for rounds 5 and 6, we've provided those results in the rankings to State Park for their use in making their management decisions. The severity of the noncompliance is scored, and park audit results are classified into one of the four agreed-on rankings that we've come up with. Based on the score, the rankings are compliant, least severe, moderately severe, and most severe. And that's, like I said, that's based on scoring. So moving ahead to round 5, which is the first round that we had where we used the scoring mechanism, we found that of the 12 parks, 4 of them were compliant with the procedures in our fiscal control plan. And the testing period for this round of audits was in March, or 6 months after the initial training session. And the results total for round 5, we had 4 parks that were compliant, 4 that were in the least severe category, 3 moderately severe, and 1 in the most severe category. So that puts 2/3 of the parks either compliant or having a minimum of errors. In round 6, we had discussed the possibility of re-auditing some of the parks that proved problematic in rounds 1 and 2. So we went ahead and included 6 of the 13 parks as re-audits. And when we finished that round, 5 of the 13 parks were compliant, of which 4 of them were re-audited. The test weeks for that were in April and May, and were 7 months following the original training sessions. Now for round 6, we had 5 parks compliant, and 4 of them that were re-audited, and 1 of them, on their initial audit, they were compliant. 2 least severe, 4 moderately severe, and 2 in the most severe category. Again, in round 7 and 8, for round 7, we've drafted the response letters and written a report, and that ought to be coming out here sometime later on this month, and we're in the process of reviewing round 8. I did want to speak a little bit about what we've done here since the beginning of the fiscal year. We had, obviously, run one of the parts audits was in September. We completed five parts in the first round. In October, we also did five parts, and for this month, we plan to do 13 parts. So far for this fiscal year, by the end of the month, we should have 23 of the parts for FY09 audited, and that will be about 48% of the total 2007 revenue that we saw, and that's what we based on the 09 audits on. Additional audits, September and October of 2009, we only went to five parts, but that's because we also added some lease concession audits to our audit plan. Within a couple of days, you should receive the Cedar Hill State Park report. That one's completed. And we have the Eisenhower State Park that's in the reporting process, and our sand and gravel audit that we're completing also. As far as administration of the office, tomorrow we're seeking approval of the FY 2009 audit plan that's required for the government code, Chapter 2102, Texas Internal Audit Act. Actually last week, I distributed the Internal Audit Annual Report that goes out to four of the oversight agencies, which is the Governor's Office, the Sunset, the LBB, and the State Auditor's Office. And I believe each of you all received a hard copy of that also. We've been working with several of the divisions, but a lot in particular with internal affairs. And what we've done is we've developed a fraud, waste, and abuse email box and a hotline that we've set up so that the public and staff can report suspected violations. As we move further down that path, I'm seeking information so that we can create some posters for the use here at headquarters and out in the field offices. And what we're also doing is taking a look at the overall policies, because some of them, well, they're located in two distinct areas, in budget and finance and in human resources. And what I'd like to do is work with Ann and HR and Mary's group so that we can consolidate and strengthen the fraud policy that we have that's currently in existence.
Who gets that information? Who is going to receive the information or actually audit or...
Let's take a look at that.
Yeah.
The way we've got the mailboxes set up is Graham Jones from Internal Affairs and I are the primaries, and we have two individuals, one in each of our sections. That's our secondary person that's going to receive it. And actually, it's going to be, I guess, up to the discretion of Graham as far as how he wants to route that out. What the Internal Audit will do is act in a supporting role for a lot of the instances that we find where there's been, any problems with fraud, waste, and abuse, or which requires, I guess, an investigation as opposed to audit work. And finally, we revised the audit charter and got it officially approved and got everybody's signature for that. And that concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have. Yes, sir.
I got this, and I'm sure each of you did, this anonymous letter about the game warden contractor.
Game warden contractor?
Yeah. Did that fall within this fraud, waste, and abuse?
Well, it potentially could. That letter was sent to commissioners as well as to, I believe, Pete Flores. And we have investigated that and found there to be...
I understand there was no substance. What I'm saying is that, is that the type of complaint that falls within the scope of this third bullet point?
Yes, sir. I believe it. I believe it would. Not only internally, if there's fraud or theft, but also with external providers, contractors, or vendors, it's essential that we take a look at those relationships too, just in case there's some wrongdoing.
Well, and also just to add to it, make sure we exonerate staff that are being falsely accused of things. So I want to make sure that we've got a fair and transparent process, because we have people that bring forth allegations that are unfounded on a very regular basis, mm-hmm. to make sure that we're able to clear their good name. We need to look at that objectively. So that's a key element of it.
Thank you for that ranking system. It helps in mentally evaluating, you know, where each park really is instead of all under the umbrella of, you know, pass or fail.
Right, yeah, so that was the problem before. It was, you know, like you say, black or white. Mm-hmm. And they were in compliance or they weren't. And this is, provides a much clearer picture, I think, for state parks in which they can base their decisions on.
Yeah, Jim, thank you for that system. I think that certainly helps us. And now we can ask the executive director some questions based on this. What are we doing with the most severe problem parks that are...
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, Scott, you want to come forward as well, too, as well, to address that, because that does give us an area to focus on that.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Walt Dabney, State Parks Director. We receive each of these audits and go through them line by line and come up with a management response for these things and follow up. I just met with my regional directors yesterday. Again, we went through all of this again as to how we're dealing with each one of these audits. I just met with the superintendent from Mustang Island just a few minutes ago, and he had just had a re-audit and did find findings on his second audit. He went from 57 to 5, and I truly do believe, with a couple of exceptions, that we are constantly improving. We are truly struggling with what is a very, some of you have seen this, a very manual situation, and we're at the same time trying to develop a very automated system, which will be text parks, which will eliminate a lot of the manual stuff that we're doing. But we are working diligently to try to address these. If in any case, and we're dealing with a couple of them right now, there's any indication that the superintendent is not taking this serious, we're going to deal with that from a disciplinary standpoint. And we discussed that as of yesterday, and we have two in the mill that is, in fact, occurring right now. That whether there's intent or just lack of success, we're going to deal with that, and we're taking it extremely serious. Our folks are trying, and they're trying hard. And if I believed otherwise, I would tell you so. But that's just this has been very difficult, and some of it's staffing, some of it's these manual processes. And I would really encourage you to go out and look at some of the things they are doing to try to make this work, and some of the things that makes it difficult to be successful in all cases. And we were sorry to have Hurricane Ike strike us, and we've got two parks that we got pretty well wiped out. We have literally taken four positions out of those two parks, four state parks. And we've established four positions that we're calling fiscal control specialists. They're not auditors. They're people that are going to go out, and each one of them is going to work for two regional directors. And they're going to go out to parks that the regional directors feel are the ones that we need to spend the most time with. And in many cases, those are the bigger parks that have the most revenue we're handling. And they will stay there from 2 hours to 2 weeks and work with this staff again, training and working with these folks to seriously improve the process. Another thing you have in state parks is this is very manual, very complex, very difficult, and our turnover rate in the positions that we're paying $9 an hour for is constant, which makes your training challenges absolutely constant. That makes it even more daunting, because you're trying to hire people at not very much money out in the middle of nowhere and get them trained up in something that's not easy to do anyway. And I'm not trying to make excuses, but this has been a challenge for all our folks in state parks, and we're taking it very seriously. And I think Carlos will tell you, we're making continuous progress, and it's not perfect yet, but some of them are getting pretty close to perfect. And then we're going to have a new automated system that we're going to have to go all the way back in, redo the fiscal control plans, retrain everybody with the new system, and start again. So it's going to be a little bit of transition here for a while.
Are some of the parks that are the most severe because of Hurricane Ike?
I know him?
No.
I don't think that anything to do with it. One of them that is severe was hammered badly by Ike, but that won't be an excuse for why we had the audit finding the way it was.
Hmm. Well, we appreciate the fact that you obviously recognize the significance and importance of what we're doing and what the function of what internal audit is. And I know Ron was not built today, but I think we've made great strides in adding there.
Thanks, sir.
We appreciate the effort.
Appreciate it.
Major, he's been right after Houston, Walt, and Scott, and Dan Charlie. I mean, came back and addressed this immediately in terms of conveying the seriousness of the issue and the expectations of the regional director and the park superintendents that we were going to comply with the fiscal controls and that that was a very, very high level expectation of this agency and the commission. So I just want you to know everybody responded right after the Houston discussion, which was very helpful in addition to the development of the severity rankings, which I think has been a very helpful management tool to allow us to know where we really need to focus our resources on where the problems are. So,
any other questions? If no further questions or comments, I will place the fiscal year 2009 internal audit plan section of the item on the Thursday commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Mr. Chairman, we are going to withdraw item number 5, and I believe that completes my committee report.
Thank you. Am I doing something here? We're going back to you.
Who's coming back?
There's a bigger gap.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We will now reconvene the Conservation Committee. We have already approved the minutes, and we will move directly to committee item number 1, update on TPW progress in implementing the TPW Land and Water Resources Conservation and Recreation Plan. Carter.
So, Chairman, just two things I want to say. One, and Scott alluded to this earlier, is we celebrated 2 weeks ago the acquisition of the Fortress Cliff Ranch up in the Texas Panhandle.
Yeah.
And protected nearly 3,000 acres through the work of Scott and Ted and Corky and others in the state parks team to acquire just a magnificent piece of Texas protected, as you know, 6 miles of frontage along that canyon rim. And it is just a spectacular jewel. Wonderful short grass prairie habitat, mule deer habitat, and just a home run for the state of Texas. And Mr. Bibbs, just want to thank you for all of your leadership and helping to make that happen and advocacy and work behind the scenes to help effectuate that. And very, very proud of that accomplishment. I hope all of you are too, because it's a great gift to the nearly 300,000 people every year that come to that great state park. So very, very special day, and it was a wonderful celebration. So
well, I would like to reiterate those thanks and thank you as well, Carter. And it truly is a beautiful piece of property, and it really will perpetuate the pristine nature of Palo Canyon in a way that we could not have done otherwise. And so it was money well spent.
Yeah, absolutely. The last thing I want to mention is that I hope that y'all get a copy of it. The Wildlife Division, really, I think under Vernon Bevel's team, and he and his team have put together an upland game bird management handbook for private landowners, kind of a one-stop shopping or clearinghouse for information for landowners that are interested in getting resources to help with management of quail and turkey and pheasant and prairie chickens and so forth. It's a great tool for private landowners, wonderful technical outreach material, and so I hope that those of you who are interested in this will make sure you see it. So that's my report. Here is it. I'll pass it around. There's yours. All right. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Moving on to committee item number 2, strategic planning for conservation, Mr. Ted Hornsworth and Mr. Scott Ward.
This is good.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, Mr. Smith, my name is Scott Morris, Deputy Executive Director of Operations. We're here today to give you a briefing on our strategic planning initiatives, a couple of major initiatives that we're moving forward on. The text in your notebook is upside down from the presentation we're going to make, so I apologize for that in advance. First, I wanted to talk about our update to our Land and Water Conservation and Recreation Plan. For those of you that are relatively new to the Commission, that plan was mandated right at the turn of the century by the legislature. The first plan was effectuated in 2001. The vision in 2001 was to redo the plan every 10 years. The vision has been evolving, and we have been doing them more rapidly than every 10 years. And in fact, in 2005, we completed an update, and we have recently gotten direction from leadership in the agency, including yourselves, to move forward with a new update. Really, we've come to realize that planning of this magnitude and this significance probably is not effective if you wait every 5 or 10 years to get it done. The landscape is changing pretty rapidly. Issues are emerging. Things like global climate change and wind energy are things that we didn't even contemplate 5 years ago. They weren't on our radar screen, at least to any significant level. So one of the things you're going to hear about today later, more from Mr. Hollingsworth, and I'll join in at times, is how we're going to try to make this work in the future rather than waiting every 5 or 10 years. In the meantime, one of the remaining, as I mentioned earlier today, we had 53 requirements when we came out of the last session. We've completed 50. One of them we'll never complete because it's an ongoing reporting process that probably we'll be doing ad infinitum. So the 52nd item is to complete a new land and water plan update, which we will do by the end of December 2009, which gives us about 13 months to complete. We will use the model that we developed in the last go-round, which is basically a aquatic ecoregion model. We are not abandoning the terrestrial model. We're just going to overlay it to an aquatic model. We will go out and have focus groups, and we're going to talk a little bit more about this as we go through the presentation, with the goal being that by December next year, we're going to come out with a new land and water plan, which will have, we think, some significant and important revisions that will make the plan more dynamic and less static. So that as we move into the future, rather than relying on a five-year kind of a process, that we may be able to use a more ongoing process to keep that plan robust and current. I will invite each of you to participate to the level you're interested in. You will be getting some information from me relatively soon about how we're going to do this, and there will be some regional focus group meetings. We're going to call those conservation forums, and you'll hear more about those in a minute. Obviously, we look to the Commission to give us direction on these kind of strategic plans, and we certainly encourage your participation either directly or indirectly as we move forward. We will make every effort to keep you in the loop. We certainly value the feedback and depend on the feedback you're going to give us about where you want us to go. So just plant that seed with you right now and invite you to be a part of this. We do think that it is important for us as we move into the strategic planning process in the agency to understand that there's lots of strategic plans out there. This plan is kind of the overarching operational plan. We have a natural agenda, which is a strategic plan that the legislature looks at in terms of our budgeting process. We have the State Wildlife Action Plan, which is very important as we move forward in the natural resource side of the agency. As you heard earlier today, we have current and future planning exercises in state parks that are going to be very important to our success in the future. We would like to develop a model that includes not only leadership at the agency, but in fact all the staff at the agency who have an interest in strategic planning. Very important for us to reach down at the grassroots level and hear from the people that touch our mission in the field, whether it be conservation or recreation, and hear from them what's important, what they need to make this successful. It's important for us to reach outside the agency to our partners. We have lots of partners in conservation. We have lots of partners in recreation. I don't want to steal Dave's thunder. I'm kind of getting off into his presentation here, but I do want to let you know that this is going to be, I hope, an exciting time for us as we try to revamp the way we do strategic planning, and I would, once again, I urge your participation. I probably can stay up with the slides very well.
Let's pick up where Scott left off. Chairman, Commissioners, good afternoon. My name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. In the Land Conservation Program, as you know, our primary mission is to look at ways to and manage our land base to maximize its value for conservation and recreation. And as you know, we have extremely limited resources for affecting land transactions, and so we're always extremely concerned that we use those resources strategically, that we look at the entire landscape and try to determine how to best apply those resources to affect the greatest amount of conservation and recreation in Texas. There are a lot of folks out there in the field who have a great deal of expertise, inside our agency, outside our agency. There are a lot of stakeholders and a lot of partners, and it's always been a concern of staff that we try to figure out how to take maximum advantage of all that expertise and all that interest. The Land and Water Conservation and Recreation Plan gives us an opportunity to bring the stakeholders together, to bring that expertise together, both inside the agency, to reach outside the agency, to reach even to private landowners for input into this process. But it also gives us an opportunity to take that structure that we create in that process and leave it intact for the purpose, essentially, of implementing the plan to make sure that first of all, we have the expertise brought to bear to determine what our highest conservation priorities are, and then to make sure that we leverage the resources we have. There are resources in the private sector, there are federal funds available. Through our relationship with TxDOT, we're hoping to increase the amount of, or the effectiveness of mitigation that's done for transportation projects in Texas. So we have opportunities as well as responsibility to make sure that those resources are applied as strategically as possible. The plan is a good, broad outline for doing that, but when it comes to being able to identify region by region what our highest priorities are, what acquisitions or what conservation easements or what partnerships or what private lands can go into management plans that would have the greatest impact on the conservation landscape, we want to make sure we're doing that efficiently. And so that's the purpose of leaving these committees together, these task forces together, in the form of the Conservation and Recreation Forum. You can see the goals on your screen there, to facilitate communication, ensure that staff, and oftentimes the staff that has the greatest immediate on the ground where the resources are, expertise, natural resources, conservation resources, are way out in the field and don't necessarily have direct input into planning processes that are taking place here in Austin. So we want to make sure that everybody's involved. We want to make sure that our partners, our NGO partners, and they don't always have exactly the same mission or the same priority, same agenda we have, but we still value their input. And we don't want to be making those decisions in a vacuum. So we have that expertise and that interest. We want to involve private landowners. I mean, 96% of Texas is privately owned. Some of the most strategic conservation pieces are still, obviously, in private hands. And again, to the extent we can, we want to pool resources with those who are interested to make sure that we leverage those, make them go as far as possible, and achieve as much conservation as we can in Texas with the limited tools that we have. Scott mentioned that we are going to stick with the strategic planning areas that were created in the last plan. They are watershed-based. We've subdivided those just a little further into now we have 12 regions that we're looking at. The committees, the task forces, are going to be managed and chaired by Parks and Wildlife staff. However, on a region-by-region staff basis, those staff members, they know who their partners are. They know who the NGOs are. They know who the trusts are. They know who even the municipalities, the cities, the state agencies are in those regions that have an interest, that have resources to bear, that have jurisdiction. And they will get those regional stakeholders involved. And they'll meet two or three or four times a year, depending upon the need, depending upon the threat, depending upon the opportunity. And then they'll report up the chain to make sure that those of us in Austin who are making decisions about how to apply those resources have the best available information and are applying those resources to the highest priorities. That's sort of it in a nutshell. Be happy to answer any questions that you have.
What are we doing differently than we've been doing in the past? relative to profit?
Let me answer that one, Mr. Chairman. That, you know, typically in the past, what we've done is we've waited until we got a mandate from your chair or the executive director's chair. We have moved out and done a limited, because it's usually time limited, exercise, of which we do make efforts to gather feedback from multiple areas within the agency, and we come back and we put a plan together. We, to some extent, put it on the shelf, and we wait 5 years and we do it over again. So what we're really trying to do here is change this culture a little bit and move more to an ongoing process where we're out in the field and with our constituents and with our partners on an ongoing basis, so that rather than waiting 5 years, that multiple times a year out into the future, what we would envision are these kinds of conservation forums or conservation and recreation forums, where we get together and talk about emerging issues and hot button issues, so that we could then, rather than wait 5 years, we may be making periodic updates to all our plans, including the land and water plan, the state wildlife action plans, and other plans as we move forward. So it's really an effort to make it more current and relevant as opposed to something that just happens from above once every 5 or 10 years.
Got more dynamic, driven by the, would be the term, the actual events changing literally as we speak. You know, you used obviously wind energy as an example. 5 years ago, we weren't spending time talking about or the global whatever. Okay.
It's also an effort to drive ownership at the level where it means something.
Yeah.
Because it's one thing for me to own the plan here in Austin and believe in it, and you and the commission, which I think we all have. It's a different story if people in the field think it's relevant to what they're doing and drives things like funding, drives some of the decisions that are being made above them.
Right.
So it really is an effort to bring the entire team, both Parks and Wildlife and the Conservation and Recreation team in Texas, together on a regular basis so that we're all bought off on what's supposed to be going on. And we are a field-driven organization, and we do think it's important to increase that ownership of the strategic plan by the people in the field.
And part of that, you need to think about how you set up a communication process and get feedback both ways.
And I'm not suggesting this will be easy. There certainly will be some dynamics, but I do think it's important. And I do think, given the communication tools that we have today, this is very doable.
There are some good models out there now. I've spent the first 11 years of my career with Parks and Wildlife on the Upper Texas Coast, and on an annual basis, we have cycles of TIAP dollars, coastal wetland planning dollars, North American wetland planning dollars, and when those cycles come up, I get together with my project, Wildlife gets together with their project, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Galveston Bay Foundation, General Land Office, and those of us who have project scope that we think, you know, the off-head projects, we get together, we sit around the table, we spread those all out, we look at the maps, we take off our agency hats, and we decide which project has the greatest bang for the buck and the greatest conservation value on a coastal-wide basis. We all throw our weight behind that project, and 100% of the time it's funded and implemented. And we'd like to make sure that that kind of cooperation and that kind of leveraging is going on across the state if we can.
I'll just add, and I think Scott's done a great job with this, Chairman. I think it's, you know, it's doing a couple things. One, it's just helping to capture all of the expertise that exists inside this agency. And so Scott and Ted are working on how do you tap that
right
on a regular, sustained basis. How do you do so in an interdisciplinary way so you can get all of those different perspectives? And then how can you be responsive and flexible enough to deal with these huge cross-cutting natural resources threats that are just changing literally with every minute? And so I think this is a great new process, and obviously they're still in the formative stages, but I think it just makes that response, it's just going to help us be sharper from a conservation and recreation perspective. So.
And there are, as Ted said, I guess I'm probably hearing this, but I didn't say this, there's a lot of this going on. I don't want to imply that the field staff are not out there strategically thinking through what goes on. It just does not get focused very well when we come to a real formal process like putting together the land and water plan. So I think it's going to take a lot of what we do that's already very good. It's going to make it a little bit better, and it's going to focus it on a real product.
Good.
Any other
issues? Yeah.
I want to also add, I think it's real unifying for the department. I think it also empowers all the people that are involved and makes them feel like they're more part of the process. I think it's great.
Thank you very much. Item number three, briefings on wind, energy issues, and development.
First, Kathy Boyd.
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, here to brief you on wind energy issues. For the record, I'm Kathy Boydson with the program leader for the Wildlife Habitat Assessment Program. Basically, Texas passed California in wind energy production in 2006, and one of the main reasons for that are we have a real aggressive renewable portfolio standard. The wind is better here than was initially thought. There's county tax abatements available, and there's no regulatory process. As you can see from the slide, we went from 2,000 megawatts of renewable energy in 1999 to 10,000 megawatts by 2025. There's currently 4,356 megawatts installed wind energy in the state. There's another 1,700 proposed under construction for 2008. So if that's completed, we'll meet our 2015 renewable portfolio standard by 2009 or early 2010. Last year, 2007, there was a 45% increase in electricity from wind energy in the United States. Of that 45%, Texas produced 20% of that. Now, this increased renewable portfolio standard and production in the state fits in with the Department of Energy 2020 plan, which is 20% of the energy from renewables by 2030 for the U.S. Now, wind energy is green, but it doesn't come without environmental concerns. The national average for bird deaths or bird mortality is about three birds per megawatt per year. Bat deaths is quite a bit higher. There's 10 bat deaths, mortalities per megawatt per year. There seems to be a trend that shows that bird deaths decrease as the turbine heights go up, but bat deaths seem to increase with height. And we think the reason is that is because bats seem to be attracted to the turbines. Now, this has been intensely studied since 2004, since they had a huge bat die-off in 2004 in wind farms. They think that part of the reason is that bats are attracted to it as maybe a roosting site, an opportunity to roost. They see it as a large dead snag, or they may be attracted to the insects that congregate on low wind speed nights around these turbines, or they may be attracted to feed on the buildup of insects on the turbine blades, or they may see it as a place to socialize and find a mate, as bats are known to be attracted to the tallest structures in the area. Now, there's not very much information at all on displacement of species by turbines. Do the turbines cause species to abandon the area once they're in place? Or on fragmentation of habitat. Does the fragmentation of habitat from turbines being there cause some species problems? The biggest concern for TCWD is the lack of data for Texas. Most of the wind farms in Texas have been in operation for several years, as many that have come online in the last 2 years. They all collected pre-construction data, but most of them have only started collecting post-construction data the last 2 years, 2006 and 2007. Now, wind companies are very reluctant to share any of their data with us because it's considered proprietary, and we don't have the authority to protect it from an open records request. One thing I was going to show you was a little video called the Bat Strike Video. This is research done by Bat Conservation International using thermal imagery. You can see the bat coming up from the lower left-hand corner to investigate the turbine, and it gets whacked by the blaze. It's some pretty interesting research going on. Now, wind energy isn't the only issue. There's also transmission lines that are associated with the increased wind energy development. In July of this year, the PUC approved Scenario 2, the transmission build-out plan for the increased wind energy development. That is going to add 2,300 miles of new 345-kilowatt transmission lines in the next 5 years, which will add an additional 18,000 megawatts of new electricity to the grid. Now, our experience and scientific research shows that transmission lines kill a lot more birds than wind turbines do, and they do fragment the habitat more that we know of. Now, Parks and Wildlife has an agreement with the Public Utilities Commission to review all new and upgraded transmission lines for impacts to fish and wildlife resources. As you can see, the Scenario 2 overlaps lesser prairie chicken estimated and occupied habitat. A five-year study done in Kansas indicated that greater prairie chickens, which are closely related to lesser prairie chickens, avoided areas when tall structures went in place, such as transmission lines or wind turbines or pump jacks, sometimes even roads or houses in these areas, caused the birds to abandon the area. More specifically, they abandoned the area when it came time to brood and rear the chicks. So what TPWD has done to be involved in wind industry is we developed some voluntary guidelines with the NGOs, the wind industry, and landowner groups. We're currently revisiting those guidelines and developing some specific guidance for different ecoregions in the state where wind energy is developing. Right now we're working on the Panhandle. The coast will be next, and then we'll start working on the other ecoregions that fall in that Scenario 2 plan. We've also initiated...
Who has regulatory authority over the placement of the wind turbines? I understand the transmission, you said PUC has that authority. Have we established any authority, and is that something the legislature is going to take a look at, in some agency actually having control over where these things go?
Well, to answer your first question, there is no regulatory authority for wind energy development in this state. The PUC regulates the transmission lines. There were several moves made in the last legislative session, and legislation introduced to regulate wind industry, and that failed. And I feel I will be surprised if there's not another move made during this legislative session, an attempt to develop some type of regulatory authority for wind energy. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thanks.
We've also initiated some research to answer some of the questions and issues that were brought up earlier. We initiated two research projects on grassland bird species, with lesser prairie chickens being the flagship species. One of those research projects is in the northeast part of the Panhandle, where the northeast population is. The other one's in the southwest part of the Panhandle, where the southwest lesser prairie chicken population is. One of those studies in the northeast part of the state is with Iberdrola, the company that's proposed to develop two sites in Gray and Donnelly County. So we partner with them on a large research project in Texas Tech University. We have an ongoing research project along the coast looking at migratory bird corridors with Cedar Clayburgh Wildlife Research Institute and the King Ranch, where we're looking at the influence that weather, vegetation, and topography have on migratory birds that come down, and what influence those different elements might have on where the migration corridor goes on an annual basis. Well, one of those studies, the study with Iberdrola, is also looking at displacement and habitat fragmentation on different species. What we're doing is looking at the number and diversity of species, particularly grassland birds, prior to construction and then after construction. We also conducted two landowner...
Please leave that. You said earlier that the wind companies won't share data with TPW because they consider it proprietary. So I don't understand how you can get data on the difference in number and diversity of species prior to construction and after construction if they're not sharing data.
Well, we're partnering on a research project with them. We're funding part of that research project, so we will have access to that data.
With this one company.
Mm-hmm.
But why can we not get that when a game warden can come on and they have probable cause to think there's a violation to investigate? Why can't we investigate the impact that these operations are having on wildlife? I just don't know. That to me doesn't seem... I don't understand that.
Well, number one, my understanding of the way the law is written is we don't have authority to require them to provide us anything because there's no pathway for us to require that information. Let's say, I'll give you an example. If there were some kind of permitting process, say through the PUC, where they said, all right, you have to go to Parks and Wildlife and ensure that your project is not impacting listed species, then we could require them to give us information about their project through that commenting or permitting process. As the state agency, the only authority we would have to look at wind projects is if we were invited onto the land by the landowner or the industry to look at those projects and comment on them. But as far as requiring them to give us the data from those projects, we don't have any authority, even under the technical guidance or wildlife management plan regulations, unless it's our specific individuals that work for the Parks and Wildlife Department that are collecting this data, which is normally not the case.
But But if we suspect that a landowner in some fashion causing or contributing to the death of an endangered species or a threatened species, like we heard about, we saw the list this morning, we'd have the right to go on to that property and investigate it, wouldn't we?
Well, only if, not in the instance of a wind-related project.
Let me answer first of all, the information that if someone has contributed to the death of an endangered species, that's really kind of that's going to be a federal issue, and we may have some authority there. Absolutely. But the issue that we've got right now is apparently there may be some information or data out there that wind energy companies or landowners have collected, not through any partnerships with Parks and Wildlife, not because we went onto their land, but they've collected it just through their own means. We don't have authority to compel them to provide that information to us.
I understand you're saying that. I'm just saying I have a problem with it. Okay, we need to ask the legislature for authority if that's right.
And you know, that's definitely going to be a policy call and a legislative call. Our authority really mainly extends to protecting information. Well, first of all, information that we collect. We don't have authority to make them give it to us. Secondly, if they voluntarily give it to us, it's subject to disclosure under the Public Information Act. And that's another, someone might be willing to voluntarily give it to us if they believe that it was going to be the confidentiality or their asserted confidentiality was going to be maintained. But we can't guarantee that either.
And the wind companies that have shared data with us have already made that data public anyway, in a fashion, such as the two projects that are going along on the coast on the Kennedy Ranch. They've given us copies of all their surveys and all the data that they've collected, because they went ahead and made that information public anyway.
But, Commissioner, you're touching on a really important issue in this whole discussion. Because we have talked about this ad infinitum with the wind energy companies and the conservation community and the scientific community about, hey, how do we standardize the survey work that's being done pre-construction and post-construction to make sure that they are collecting data in the same way so it's all relevant. You're comparing it apples to apples. And then secondly, would there be some impartial, objective third party that could house that data so that scientists and others could have access to it to evaluate it so that we can learn from it? And that's the real issue. The companies, of course, are concerned, and perhaps rightfully so, that their own data may be used against them in a punitive way. So we have not been able to work out any kind of a compromise on this issue, but it's a priority for all of us who are wanting to more scientifically understand the impacts of this, and we just haven't been able to crack that nut yet.
The last two legislatures definitely have been strong pushes to try to get the PUC to set up some kind of permit system.
But just why
don't you stick one of these things up in the air and then you hook it up to a transmission line and all of that? And the companies have strongly fought it, and so far have been able to win the legislature.
Well, the department's being stiff-armed on data that it needs to collect to have reliable empirical conclusions. At the same time, they're putting them up as fast as they can put them up, and then they're there.
Yeah, but my argument is on the other side. That's my private property. I have a right to put that windmill up there. Why does Texas Parks and Wildlife need to be coming on there to find out whether a bat ran into it or not? Okay? I mean, when you drive down the road, I'm not trying to be argumentative, in your car every day, I'm not taking empirical information to find out whether you killed a bug that day or not. The argument is, this is a political football. It's huge. It's going to get really bigger and bigger, of course, because it's becoming such a large issue. And then with the PUC allowing this almost $5 billion worth of transmission lines eventually to be able to be built, my guess is it will finally end up in a permit type of system, probably through the PUC, of which at that time we will be involved. And what I'm going to be interesting is, which is interesting, because remember, these have been around for quite a while, California, other countries, there is very little empirical or scientific data that's gone on over the years. So the conservation groups and others that have tried to argue against them have never been able to really come up with you know, the study done in 2003, you know, in California showed that, you know, 10,000 birds were killed an hour or whatever it was. So we've got a while to go, but right now we have no right to, no rights whatsoever.
And they do meet with us. Since we initiated the voluntary guidelines, we've seen an increase of, you know, 50% or more of wing companies that are coming to us saying, look, we're wanting to develop in this area. And they show us their data, they ask us to give input on the sites where they're going to develop. And then they may come in a year or so later and say, here's our pre-construction survey. And they go through a show us a program or slideshow or something, and we have to take notes. Because, you know, I say, you know what I'm going to ask is, can I have a copy of your report or your presentation? And they won't give it to us. They don't mind us taking notes. But we have been, we received a Freedom of Information Act request three or four times now. We've tried to get that information withheld through the Attorney General's office, and we've been refused every time. Because we tell them we think it's proprietary, and we'd like to maintain that confidentiality, and they've denied us that.
Fight's coming. But there's a lawsuit filed, and it's becoming, it's going to be a big one in this legislature, and I mean it's coming. There's no doubt about it.
And one thing, we did try the soft approach. The same group that we put together for that did the guidelines. One of the first things we did was develop some language when the PUC was developing that first rulemaking process for the CREZ rules and the CREZ process. We developed some language with the landowner group and the NGOs that everybody was satisfied with that could have been inserted into the PUC rules that said Parks and Wildlife would review these wind power projects. And the PUC wouldn't put that in there because they said that was giving us authority that they didn't have the authority to delegate to us. So we tried the soft approach in trying to go forward to them and saying, hey, we really want to work with you on this and you know, make this a part of your process. And we tried it once. You know, I think you're right. I think if it happens again, it's going to have to be legislatively mandated.
I wonder what the PUC does if some landowner that owns a couple of oil wells all of a sudden he springs a leak in his transmission lines going to the main transmission line. He dumps a bunch of oil out there on his private property. Does PUC have the authority to go out there and...
the Railroad Commission does. Remember, that's been developed over many, many years. And it's going to happen with the wind power system and generation system also. But remember, it's so new that hasn't been developed. But in that case, it would have been the Railroad Commission. And yes, they would be out there. And, they would have rights and certain things they could do to stop either the landowner or the producer or whatever from doing those kinds of things.
How about Ralph? It seems like it was good for Peter, it would be good for Paul.
We did also conduct two landowner wind wildlife workshops in Abilene and Amarillo that were very successful and well attended. We have two more of those planned for Lubbock and Corpus Christi in 2009. Our partners on those workshops were Texas Wildlife Association, Texas AgriLife, and several members of the wind industry. We also have state agency representation on the federal advisory committee that's developing voluntary guidelines for wind industry. And we are on the Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies on the Energy and Wildlife Policy Committee and the Wind and Wildlife Subcommittee that look at these energy issues on a national level.
What does the 200 behind Abilene mean?
That means how many people attended the conference. 200 people in Abilene, 200, and then 240 attended the one in Amarillo.
Since that's been a year ago, is it possible to do another one? Perhaps early 09?
Another one in Abilene?
Yes, because it seems to be, that's an area where there's a great deal of this construction going on.
We could look at doing that probably... it's a little late to be doing that right now before February, but we could look at doing one after the one in Lubbock if you would want us to take up that.
Well, I just think a lot of landowners have no idea what they're getting into, and the wind people are certainly not, either they don't know or they're not going to volunteer it.
And these workshops, it seems to me, are very helpful to landowners to understand that there may be some risks they're taking with these leases that they may not want to take with their property. And I just, as I look at that geographically, it seems to me that Abilene is kind of a center spot there for a lot of development, both on the west side and now moving northeast towards Albany. I would urge that we can find the time and staff to try to slot them in sometime.
We could certainly do that one. We'll certainly do another one. We have plenty of time to do it, you know, later on in the spring, I think. It takes us a couple of months usually to put something like this together.
And that, Commissioner, that's a very reason why we're doing this in the panhandle, because many landowners are confronted right now with that choice, but they have not yet made a choice. And so, I mean, we've been working very closely with Commissioner Bivens on this, and we had such positive feedback after the Amarillo one that we decided to do one in Lubbock shortly thereafter.
And I think the Lubbock one will be able to, in a lot of ways, address some of the issues that you're referring to on a subsequent meeting in Abilene. I mean, the geographic proximity is close enough that I think you could have some overlap.
And we'd invite you to come to that. Commissioner Bivens came to the one in Amarillo and the one in Abilene as well.
It's the Red Raiders playing. Just got you. Really cute,
Abilene. I have to tell you that Oklahoma State Cowboys are playing this weekend.
Who's that?
Yes, sir.
No. 6/7.
Class of 83.
That hurt. When John went there, it was Oklahoma,
but Boone was just in the wind.
I'm going to push back just in case. Actually, you know, the landowner workshops were really well balanced. We tried to make an effort to present both sides, you know, didn't slant them either for or against wind. We had attorneys there. We had people presenting wind industry members, and then we had people from the Fish and Wildlife Service and Parks and Wildlife presenting information about the potential impacts of wind on wildlife.
So, was it just wind, or how about the transmission line?
Well,
infrastructure?
The last one in Amarillo, we had somebody from the PUC talk, and we also addressed some of the transmission line issues, because up until that point, we knew that the transmission was coming, but we didn't have any idea where or how or, you know, what form the plan was going to take shape. And so once that we knew that this scenario was out there and was going to be approved, that's when we drew that transmission issue into the workshop, and we will be addressing that from now on in the areas where it's appropriate. Now, along the coast, that won't be such a big issue in the coastal area, because there's already sufficient transmission down there right now, and there wasn't a lot of interest in developing along the coast, but I think now there will be increased interest. But that's outside that scenario to transmission, that zone. So any transmission that's been tried to develop along the coast is going to take back burner to these other projects that are in this area too. Unless it's privately developed. Are there any other questions? If that's it, that concludes my presentation.
I just have one. I know last spring there was a potential bill in the House, I mean, nationally, that's coming up for at least some siting regulations. It was under the Natural Resource Commission. I can't remember the man's name who sat on the committee. I'm assuming it just died, but I wondered if they were thinking of any other.
Well, they're still looking at, they've looked at reintroducing or reauthorizing the production tax credit. That's one bill. And the other bill, I'm sure, will be reinstated under the new administration. And we are working, there are national guidelines being developed right now for wind energy development by the Federal Advisory Committee. And that process is going on and should be concluded probably by October 2009. Now, whether those remain voluntary or become regulatory will be up to the Department of the Interior and the Congress. I think the recommendation from that committee will probably be that they become regulatory. Anything else?
Thank you very much. The next speaker to this topic is Linda Campbell with recommendations by the Private Lands Advisory Board regarding wind energy development. Welcome, Linda. And Dr. Bill Eichenhorn.
Yes, good afternoon, Commissioners and Mr. Smith.
I'm going to do my best to represent the Private Lands Advisory Board. Dr. Eichenhorst, the chairman, was here, but due to the late hour, he had to leave for another meeting. But I'm going to go through this with you. The Private Lands Advisory Board has been interested in this subject for a number of months, and so they have developed this written advisement for the commission, and I think Carol is passing this out to you right now. Just to remind you that the purpose of the Private Lands Advisory Board is to advise Texas Parks and Wildlife Department on matters pertaining to wildlife programs, management, and research on private lands. And as you can see on your slide there, those are the current members. Dr. Eichenhorst is the current chairman. He also wanted me to thank you for providing this opportunity for the board to present this advisement to you. Some of the concerns that they looked at, limited knowledge and experience concerning wind energy has left Texas landowners without a clear understanding of the potential unintended consequences of these developments. Unsuccessful attempts to regulate wind development have encouraged developers to expand Texas wind farms at a rather feverish pace, and we've all seen that. The PLAB unanimously supports private landowners and private industry's ability to develop and capture economic values consistent with responsible wildlife and wildlife habitat management practices. However, based upon staff presentations, the Private Lands Advisory Board is of the opinion that wind development, which is long-term in nature, may have adverse effects upon wildlife and wildlife habitat. A little background. The board met on May 21st and then again on August 21st and heard presentations by a number of TPWD staff regarding wind energy development in Texas. Following extensive discussions, and there were quite extensive discussions on this from this board, they wish to provide interim advisement to the department's leadership for current and future consideration relative to wind development issues. I was asked to say that also the board approached the construction of this advisement to be pro-wildlife and wildlife habitat and not pro or anti-wind development. They were trying to be very focused on looking at the wildlife aspect of this. So I'd like to just go through these points of advisement quickly with you. There are six advisement points, not arranged in any particular order of importance or priority. Point number one, the board recommends that TPWD actively invest resources into researching, analyzing, and evaluating the potential impact of wind energy development on habitat component integrity, including impacts on spatial arrangements. Point number two, the board recommends that the department begin work promptly and actively to address the lack of data relative to wind development impacts on wildlife and wildlife habitat. The board recommends that the commends the department for initiating the compilation of the best management practices for wind development on an ecoregion basis, and Kathy referred to that earlier on the working on the panhandle practices, and recommends immediate action to develop BMTs as soon as possible on a prioritized basis for all regions of Texas that offer wind energy development potential. Point number four, the board recommends that the department explore and adaptively employ all pathways of research and data accumulation that enhance landowner and or wind developer confidence to share data, including but not limited to existing and future written wildlife management plans on properties with wind development, existing and future technical guidance relationships with landowners and their agents, and qualified research projects with credentialed researchers and institutions. The board recommends that the department actively magnify its role as a current and objective educational resource to all invested stakeholders
in wind development. Stakeholders including landowners who are considering wind development, industry developers, local, regional, and state decision makers, and state and federal agencies. Point number six, the board recommends that the department actively engage and educate not only landowners considering wind development, but also the Texas public as the true stakeholders of Texas wildlife and wildlife habitat. As the ultimate end users of energy, Texans deserve ready access to the most current and objective information available regarding the potential unintended consequences of wind energy product development and transmission thereof to them as energy consumers. So in conclusion, the Private Lands Advisory Board feels strongly that TPWD should become the strongest voice to represent the interests of wildlife resources in the face of the changing Texas landscape. And that's all I have, and I will be happy to try to answer any questions on behalf of the board or take back any questions you might have to the chairman and vice chairman.
Commissioner. Chairman Bivens.
This wind business, I think, really needs to have our strongest support. And I'm wondering, and I'm just wondering out loud, thinking out loud, would it might behoove Texas Forest and Wildlife to have a committee of commissioners, say a three-person committee, somebody that knows the law real good, be included in there to assist Texas Wildlife Association, this group, to make a statement to everyone concerned that Texas Parks and Wildlife is concerned about this, we're concerned about all these things that Ms. Campbell just now read off those six items, and for them to be charged with the responsibility of being a very intimate liaison to the legislature. And between the legislature and the department and private landowners in the state of Texas.
In my mind, to answer your point, I think that we can, without forming an ad hoc committee, can put forth to the public our stance on wanting to maintain the habitat and livelihood of all wildlife with regard to wind energy and all, and also conservation issues with the land that these wind farms are being built on. With regard to a liaison to the legislature, I think that we need to probably get a little bit more information with regard to the thing that concerns me is that we're not particularly empowered to do anything. And because of that lack of empowerment, I think all we can do directly with the legislature would be to just share our ideas and share our concepts with them, but we can't, by any legislative means, require that they do anything or unless they empower us to do it.
But I'd not say empower a committee to go down there and act as a lobbyist or anything else, but have a committee and let the legislature know that we have this committee and we would like for them to funnel information through this committee to the commission and to the department. I just think that this is so important that we should consider some additional assistance to staff. Just to send a signal.
If I may, I think one of the most helpful things for all of us would be some sort of clear direction from y'all that you think this is indeed important, is a critical issue. We need to be directing more time and resources and research into this. We interface with the legislature almost daily at some level on this issue, as well as our partners that are working on this. And in fact, we'll be participating in a hearing down at the Capitol next week on wind and wildlife. And so I just want you to know that issue is going on. We're probably not doing as good a job, and let me take responsibility for that failure, on communicating upwards to y'all everything that's happening on the wind and wildlife front. We have talked about internally the need for a position paper on wind energy that clearly articulates where the department stands. And maybe with your permission, we could move forward with developing that draft and bring it back to you for consideration and approval, because I think having the commissions and premature on that will certainly help as we're working on this around the state. So it's that kind of direction. We feel like it's a priority. You've heard from our biologists on this matter that it is a subject of concern. We lack data. We need to do more research. We are trying to maintain our objectivity here in the face of a whole lot of a lack of data. But we obviously are concerned. We also recognize it's a priority for the state in terms of diversifying energy sources, and we want to make sure that we're careful there in terms of not impeding that state goal. So the more direction you can give to us as to what kind of a priority you want us to make, it would be helpful right now.
I think, Commissioner Parker, it would be in our best interest currently for us all as individuals to convey our ideas to Carter, and then perhaps let Carter determine if an actual committee is necessary or if the entire commission should act as that committee. Any other comments or questions from Linda?
Remind me where the private lands advisory board comes from. I mean, how are they appointed?
Linda does a great job with them. John, I understand what you're talking about. I think it makes sense, but I think that's Carter's job, the executive director, is staying focused on what's going on with this. And since this is such two things that obviously kind of happened overnight in one way, and I'm talking about the size that it's become, and secondly, it is so politically sensitive, particularly going as legislators, that and we are involved already, is that through Carter and whoever he chooses within his organization that he stays involved. I do agree. I think one of your jobs then is to keep us informed of then how things are going, whether it's the meeting next week, whether you want to do it through a memo, or how you feel is the right way to keep us informed, particularly as we head into January.
Well, I think so. I mean, it's going to be supported by scientific data. I don't know what to get that. It's just to say it's bad, don't like it, or whatever. We've got to have some basis to make decisions based on scientific data.
And I
think that applies to our department. That's what we do.
I think we're in that data gathering process. I mean, wouldn't you agree?
And that's actually been some of the frustration with some of the individuals, as you can imagine, and that's if you want to be against this, because my answer to them has been, let's find the science. We looked for the science about a year or two ago, could not find anywhere in the world. And said to them at that time, I won't name individuals and people involved, we'll be glad to do it. We'll need funding from the legislature to help us try to get that funding. That did not work out directly, but then I did ask Carter and others to get involved because I knew it was coming, and it is coming. But we then get involved as much as we can relative to the position we're in right now. Knowing it's going to be like water. It's only a matter of time before it will become regulated, before it will become a major issue across the state. And we will want to be one of the players sitting at that table. There's no doubt about it. But I would like our executive director to direct us on how the best way to go about that.
Can we not at least say we obviously endorse this interim paper that has come from the advisory board, and that's what they're...
Yeah. I mean, it's straightforward from my point of view. I don't know how everybody else feels about it. Again, it comes from an advisory board to an agency. So I guess all I want to do is make sure I say things the right way. Because one of the big disagreements that I had was, well, if we wait on science, it will take too long. And I said, well, at Texas Parks and Wildlife, the reason that we have the credibility we have is because we do things scientifically. And the attitude was, and they've been right so far, is, you know, half the state's going to be covered with them before you guys figure out whether they kill a bird or not. Seems to be sarcastic. And I said, that may be true, but I'm not going to give an opinion or a political reaction to something that maybe is my own opinion or political reaction with Texas Parks and Wildlife's name on it and call it science. Okay? Just can't do it, won't do it, it's not the right thing to do, and at the end of the day, it'll kill the credibility of anything we say anyway. That this is one of the issues. This thing's moved so fast, it's gotten ahead of everybody. So I just want to make sure we don't get caught up, Jen said it's the right way, being on whatever side is the right side, wrong side, and I have no idea, but that we do it the way we've always done it in Texas Parks and Wildlife, which is the right way. So if that has to take 3 years, by then half the state is covered with these darn things roaring around your backyard.
Well,
and, I'm not trying to be sarcastic, but I'm sorry, but we, you know, I don't want to do it any other way. I just don't think it would be right for that agency or anybody in the agency to just give their opinion about something. So.
To your point, too, Peter, I think there will be another agency at this point.
Well, there will be
involved.
Oh, there will be plenty of people involved this time. Yes. But we want, and I do want to see it at the table. Oh, absolutely. I think absolutely, just like with water, we have a seat at the table. I'm asking Carter to make sure we have that seat at the table.
I have one question I would like to ask, and I'll direct the question generally, but how much more time do we need to generate an accurate data set on this? I mean, Kathy, you may more directly answer this than me.
I'll defer to Kathy.
Well, you know, normally when we conduct research in the agency, we don't like to do anything more than, you know, 2 or 3 years minimum on any type of research. And that's been the problem with the wind industry is, you know, they can develop a project in 18 months.
Sure.
So they come to us and say, we're going to develop in Gray County, and we want to do 1 year pre-construction survey, and that's all the data you're going to get because we have to, you know, develop within a year to take advantage of the production tax credit is one thing.
Yeah, so, remember, this is all subsidized.
Right.
Yes.
We're our friends and president.
And what?
There's no money out.
One of the things that we have looked at doing in the Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies is in this next administration pointing out to them to the fact that the production tax credit only being authorized every in 1 or 2 year increments puts the environmental scientific community at odds with the wind industry for that very reason. So one of the things we have suggested with the association is to investigate the support we might get for putting a letter out requiring Congress to authorize it in, say, a 4 or 5 year increment, which would give us more pre-construction time to collect the data, and then also, you know, more time to collect post-construction data. And the wind industry is very favorable in that because that takes the pressure off them as well to develop, to try and get that credit. So that's one of the things that we're looking at doing, but to answer your question, we feel like, you know, it's not that 1 year's worth of data is worthless, but, you know, if you're looking at it, if you do it all year round, you try to catch all four seasons of all the different bird species, for example, grassland birds, you know, there's so many influences that could the things that could happen. It could be a dry year or wet year, you know, that can influence what's going on at that particular site. So we try to, like right now, the research project that we were talking about in Gray and Donnelly County on the Lesser Prairie Chickens, they're only giving us 2 years pre-construction, you know, on collecting data on Lesser Prairie Chicken there because they're trying to start construction on their project.
Do any of the ones that are up and running give you post-construction data?
No. I have to be honest.
They will. Oh, sure.
Right. And, you know, and they would, and they have told me, you know, that they would share data with us if we could protect that data. But we can't protect it under the authority that we have now or not have, however you want to look at it. So what we're recommending to them normally is we tell them we like to see, you know, 1 to 2 years pre-construction in certain areas. It depends on where the area is. If there's sites that have gone up already and we feel like the habitat is not that critical, and we'll say 1 to 2 years. If it's in a critical spot, we tell them 3 years pre-construction and 3 years post-construction. But a lot of times they say, well, that's real nice, but, you know, we're only going to do 2 or 1.
So it's gotten caught up $150 a while. You know, we need electricity.
Uh-huh.
And, it's green, so politically it's correct. You have a legislature, at least a few legislatures, including the state leadership, absolutely does not want a permit process at all for this. I think the $700 billion that's being given away and add whatever to it, I think they have already renewed the year was coming up. I think they threw that in there, so it's now the subsidy's renewed for another year.
Mm-hmm.
So my point is, you know, kind of the you know, became the, what am I trying to say, the big storm that all came together at the same time, where it's moving even faster than people expected. And I don't see it slowing down anytime soon, so it doesn't give science really time to catch up with the problem.
I think, as you said, just Chairman, in the interim, one of the things we can do is push very, very hard to get these voluntary siting guidelines that we're developing by ecoregion, and that needs to be a priority for us. I think that will be very helpful because the more we can articulate where there are sensitive resources that should be avoided from an ideal perspective, that will help inform the discussion and inform the debate. Obviously, we do not have any regulatory muscle or wherewithal behind those recommendations, but for landowners and wind developers that are risk sensitive, that information is important as it is for their investors. So that is something that we can move ahead with pace that I think would be helpful with the best information that we have now.
Well, unfortunately, you know, somebody that looks at hundreds of development projects every year across the state, there's no easy answers, you know, for the energy needs of the state. We're also looking at 2 nuclear power plants, expansion of one, and then 2 new proposed plants, one in Victoria and one up in Amarillo. So, you know, it's kind of like you've got to pick what you want to do to provide your energy and look at which is, from our perspective, which is the least damaging to the fish and wildlife resources of the state.
I would just like to say in conclusion, as a representative of the board, they care very much about this and have really discussed it in great detail and with a lot of passion.
Yeah.
And so I guess their main interest is that Parks and Wildlife be at the table and the educational component so that landowners can make informed decisions is one thing that they were very serious about.
At one comment, we did kind of float the draft panhandle guidelines to the industry, and the response was kind of interesting. Right now, what they're telling me is that instead of doing, say, 2-year pre-construction, 2-year post-construction study in each individual site, what they are more interested in doing is partnering in a larger research project they could contribute to. In other words, we would have a set of standard protocols for doing pre- and post-construction surveys that they would either hire their consultants to do and follow and contribute the data to us, or we would partner in with them and help them conduct that research. So that's something that we are looking at, and they are interested in partnering on to help us answer some of the questions that we need to get answered. And you know, the
kind of the main, more we partner with them, you know, the better access we'll have to the data and those kinds of things.
Okay. We better keep moving on, I guess. Thank you very much. It's just a very complex issue. There's no doubt about it. And moving the speed of lightning, there's no doubt about it. What else do we have here?
Thank you for those presentations. Items number 4 and 5 on your agenda have been withdrawn. We will therefore move to item number 6, update on Hurricane Ike's impact on TPW facilities and TPW's hurricane response efforts. Mr. Scott Ward.
Chairman, Commissioner, this is me. I'm Scott Ward, and I've let you know who I am and what I do. Appreciate the opportunity here to come today to give you a little perspective view of what happened to us with Hurricane Ike. I will tell you that I occasionally provide quite a bit of consternation to my staff because I don't follow the well-scripted documents that they have for me, so they've informed me that I better keep up with the slides this time. Hurricane Ike formed out in the Atlantic in early September this year, as you know. It was rolling towards the Texas coast. There's a picture of it. Early predictions were that it would hit somewhere a little further south than this, but early on there were prognostications that it could hit anywhere along the Texas coast. It went over shore on September the 13th this year as a Category 2, right on the brink of being a Category 3. Hit the coast of Texas pretty dramatically at Galveston. As the storm moved in, the surge began to take its toll. This is a picture of a bait camp on the Texas City Dyke just before the storm as the surge began to hit the coast. There were 37 deaths associated with this hurricane, and there are over 200 folks still missing and unaccounted for. So this is a picture that I thought you might be interested in. This is the Bolivar Peninsula just before the hurricane. This is the Bolivar Peninsula the next day. But if you go back and forth, you can see there was a lot of development there. You can see how broad and substantial the peninsula was. Essentially, all the structures are gone. The landscape is completely impacted there. The agency began planning about a week and a half, significant planning about a week and a half prior to the impact. The law enforcement division in particular worked closely with the State Operations Center, which is the law enforcement organization that kind of coordinates law enforcement activities out there. Some 250 game wardens over several weeks were deployed to East Texas, both before the hurricane hit and after the hurricane hit, not only to do search and rescue, but to enforce the law out there. So some of them were on the coast actually doing searches and looking for folks that were stranded or worse. Others were a little further inland. One of the things that I thought was really interesting is that the surge was 25 feet, 20 miles inland in certain places. So pretty significant surge that hit there. Day two, I will say that internally, in addition to law enforcement activities with the State Operations Center, the State Parks Division has, in previous events, put together a very strong central operations center here at the headquarters. They were kind of the spear point for this time, and within a day or two after the strike, we had all divisions that were impacted involved in that command center here, so that all communications to the field and from the field were coordinated through a command center in this very room that was populated by folks from all the divisions. I will tell you that prior to the storm hitting, all the divisions with the assets at risk did a great job, a very comprehensive job of getting their people and their equipment moved inland, away from danger as much as possibly. Something we can all be very proud of. State Parks made the decision early on to once again make their facilities available to the evacuees, which at some point numbered close to 6,000 folks that came out of the impacted areas and took shelter in our state parks. We waived entry fees. We allowed them to camp for free, and we gave them pretty significantly reduced fees for cabins and those kinds of assets there. These are just pictures. I wanted you to get a good look at that. Folks bought their tents and camped out. This happens to be at Garner State Park.
Here's some pictures of our game wardens, once again deployed for search and rescue and law enforcement activities along the coast and inland and affected areas. Gives you kind of a perspective of some of the damage that was seen. That's in Seabrook, Texas, Chambers County. Homes were completely destroyed there. Businesses severely impacted. Recreation severely impacted. These were boats along the Gulf Freeway in Galveston. And in addition, there were lots of other impacts, not necessarily related to what we do, but certainly where we tried to provide assistance. There were some 20,000 cattle and horses lost in this episode. Very significant. We had three main areas that we focused on in terms of the presentation. The first thing that was most important to us was to take care of our staff. We had about 900 employees in the affected areas, 66 to 70 of whom, with the number moves around a little bit, were significantly impacted and were, in fact, displaced from their residences. As Walt mentioned earlier, a lot of folks in Galveston and Seagram and some of the other state parks were also impacted because their places of employment were destroyed. We immediately took action to get those folks taken care of the day of the hurricane, so many of them went to stay with families and friends and relatives. Mr. Smith authorized an emergency leave for those folks to be able to take care of their own and get their own business and their own private lives in order. Luckily, we suffered no fatalities as in terms of the agency personnel, and really we suffered no major injuries. There were some minor injuries here and there, but nothing really dramatic. One of the things we did, here's an example of a resident at Galveston Island State Park. Actually much worse than it looks. I happened to land at this spot the day after the hurricane hit. When you go over to that foundation, that building had been moved 10 feet off its foundation and had been 9 feet of water inside of it. So very significant damage. That building is gone. And in fact, there were really essentially no structures left at Galveston Island or Seagram that were salvageable, maybe with one small exception. So those two parks completely destroyed. Back to the personnel issues, which were our first concern. As I said, we gave folks emergency leave to deal with the things they needed to deal with. Primarily the parks division, but not exclusively. There were some other divisions who had staff that were impacted in terms of their residences. Made efforts to relocate those staff, both in terms of where they were going to live, and then state parks in particular made efforts to reassign those folks to other parks and other duties as assigned, as Walt described. Some four of those out of Galveston went on to try to help out with our fiscal control effort while we were trying to figure out where else they might be. At the direction of Director Smith, the Human Resources Division put together an effort to raise money for our own staff to try to do a disaster relief effort for them. We were successful in raising about $117,000 in funding, which was distributed this last week to those staff most dramatically impacted. The amounts of money range anywhere from a few hundred dollars to several thousand dollars for those employees to try to assist with their immediate needs. After our people, our second most important focus was on the natural resource impact in East Texas. This happens to be a picture of some petroleum tanks that were moved back into a marsh in Galveston Bay. We flew over the J.D. Murphy area the day or two after. It's really hard to see in here. That bottom picture to the left is a little better to show you that there was an oil sheen completely over the area. Saltwater intrusion was pretty dramatic, as you can see there. That bottom one was a wetlands restoration project, which now is covered in oil and saltwater. Talk a little bit more about that in a minute. We had some 200 kills and spills reports from different folks. Some of those were very dramatic. Some of them were not so dramatic. This chart, I'm not going to spend much time on it. Those that are green dots, we have had our kills and spills team already out there to look at those, try to develop some kind of remediation efforts. I'll answer more questions later about that. Natural resource impacts are significant. Increased marsh salinities, loss of emergent marshes, wildlife displaced due to saltwater inundation, waterfowl disruptions.
This could last for quite some time. These areas that were inundated with salt water may be leaching salt for many years to come. Every time it rains, there were significant oil spills. There were negative impacts to hunting. We canceled some hunts. We limited access to some of the waterfowl hunting areas. As I said earlier, several of our WMAs there were under 3 or 4 feet of water. We expect it to be pretty dramatic this year. However, I mean, we do expect these natural resource damages to some extent to mitigate over time. There may be some hidden linings here that are positive in terms of increased seed production from early successional plants and those kind of things. Challenge you to tell me what that is in the back of that pickup truck. It's not any gimmick.
Lion.
It is a lion. It's an African lion, not a mountain lion from Texas. There were, I think, 2 tigers and 2 or 3 lions that got away from somewhere on the Baja Peninsula. Our folks helped chase them down and take care of those critters.
Interesting having the cat.
Yeah, I was Kevin looking at the cat. In addition, I mean, there were impacts to other state parks that were the most significant damage. There were several parks that were completely destroyed, another half dozen or so with pretty significant impacts, and another half dozen with less significant impacts. Candy Hampshire Wildlife Management Area, which is right behind Galveston Bay, that we quickly got, and we still have yet to start the cleanup effort there in any significant way, or that we have 30 to 40 acres of that wildlife management area that are covered with 12 feet of debris. So it's going to be a significant cleanup effort as we move forward. Coastal fisheries folks did experience some damage. Their Port Arthur office was significantly damaged. I guess the good news there is we leased that property, so we're looking for other property to move into, but it has displaced some staff there. The Dickinson office was damaged some from the rain and wind, and the Sea Center Texas had some minor damage, nothing major. But there were cross-divisional impacts, and here's another, I'm sorry, as I said earlier, 40 sites, I kind of gave you the distribution of those. This is the J.D. Murphy area the day before the hurricane. There it is the day of the hurricane. And there it is a week or two later. Back goes up. There it is before, during. That's a combination, it doesn't show very well, that's a combination of course, salt water and oil all over the area. And debris left behind. Battleship Texas, we had quite a scare. The Battleship Texas is of course moored along the ship channel in Houston. San Jacinto battleground area there. The reason I put the little insert with a circle there, that happens to be the concessions building. You'll notice in the small insert down to the left of the concessions building. You see the circle up in the center there. That building was completely underwater. A little bit of the roof was showing. A bigger scare for us was the fact that the ship was moored on piles that actually we had some early predictions would not sustain the ship, that the boat would lift off of its moorings under the surge and move out into the ship channel. So Carter and I and Walt and many of the state park staff the night before were scrambling to try to arrange barges and other mechanisms to respond to that potential emergency. Luckily, the good news is I went down there the day after, as I said, I flew down and did a tour of the area with law enforcement. We had about 2 feet to spare. If we'd have got a 2 foot higher surge, the battleship would have probably floated off its moorings and gone somewhere else. Not that everybody would have been a little disappointed.
One last venture out.
This is just one lettering is the beautiful headquarters building at Galveston Island State Park. One of the ironies of this, and I thought you might just take interest in this when Walt and I were down there, we did notice you can't see it in this picture along the left-hand wall. All your pictures are still hanging on the wall. and the water line goes right through the middle of the picture, so about 10 feet up on the wall.
That would be a big
so it well represented in the aftermath.
This is the upper right hand picture here are the restrooms that were completed about 3 months ago on Galveston Island. Spent a lot of money and a lot of time getting these. You've heard of some of our previous frustrations about getting these completed. We had just completed these, as we have, by the way, some significant projects at CRAM that were totally destroyed. There's CRAM. Looks like a lot of sticks sticking out of the sand. There were but that was a building. What's more dramatic from the air is when you look at the concrete there, and you can get a sense of it here from some of the roads that run out from the parks. The concrete was completely fragmented, broken, shifted, moved around.
It's like Dr. Falcone in that picture. Gordon out there.
There's another picture of Candy Asher. Now, what do we do next? Well, we're working closely with FEMA. FEMA covers damaged facilities, water control structures, equipment, debris removal, emergency response, law enforcement. I will tell you that we have yet to get fully reimbursed from the Rita episode 4.5 years ago, so I'm not going to make any predictions about the timeliness of the reimbursement. The good news is for the law enforcement response, we have been reimbursed for that from Rita, and that was fairly timely, and it's not an insignificant number. FEMA reimburses us for debris removal and for 75% on a reimbursement basis for facilities repair. As most of you remember, in Rita, the state is self-insured, and therefore the agency did not have insurance to cover hurricane damage. We were allowed to go back and retroactively purchase insurance for those facilities that were damaged in Rita, which then triggered FEMA's supposed reimbursement of 75%, which we have yet to get. All of it. We've got bits and pieces of it. So we are once again going through the exercise. We have been told by FEMA that we may do the same thing. However, we're probably going to go one step further, and we're just going to insure all of our facilities along the coast, because given climate change and some of the trends that we're seeing, this is probably not the last time this will happen. So our plan is to move aggressively to get reimbursement as quickly as we can for this particular episode and to cover ourselves with insurance for future episodes. There is one pilot program out there that I want to target, like Linda has said, for cleanup alone. This is not for repair of structures, but for debris removal. They will reimburse 100% of anything we can get done by December the 31st of this year. So we're moving post-haste with that. We're out right now getting contractors on the ground. We've actually had some success there. So we are rapidly trying to, as much as possible, get that debris removed, 100% reimbursement level. That concludes my presentation. I'd be glad to answer any questions. Very proud of the agency. Everyone responded quickly. There was a bittersweet lining here, as this organization showed its true colors to its staff and to the natural resources of Texas, and I applaud everybody for having that part.
You and your group did a great job.
Outstanding.
You handled it beautifully, and not only took care of yourselves, but then took care of all those that needed help. So it paid off. You seen, as you said, Rita, Trina, Holly, and Ike, not the next one, who knows, you're right. So we may just have to do the insurance thing.
Well,
inside, we're going to have them along the coast. We're going to have to figure out how to pay for them.
Yes, sir.
To the extent there's a shortfall on the FEMA reimbursement, is this the kind of thing that we can supplement our request to the legislature on, like, the parks, the damage to the two parks or not?
Yes. Yes, we actually did. The governor's office and the OBB had requested from us estimates as to the repair that we're going to have to undergo in terms of a dollar estimate. We reluctantly provided them with some numbers that are our best guesses. I mean, there is, for example, we have yet to get folks on the ground in some of these areas, because some of these areas, well, CMM is a good example, only residents and law enforcement are allowed in there as of today. And so we don't have a good number, Commissioner. We have thrown out our best estimate of $75 to $100 million to try to repair what we see out there right now. So we will continue to hone those numbers. Some of the parts we have better estimates than others, because we have had engineers out to look at some of the parts we can get to easily. I think a bigger question for us internally is what we're going to do in terms of rebuilding.
Are we going to rebuild CREM where it is like it was? And you know, at this point, we haven't made those decisions. I think it would behoove us to take our time and come up with some answers that make sense for the future. If we do, and to the extent we do rebuild along the coast, we probably will be looking at building techniques that we've not employed in the past that will be more expensive but will be more resistant to hurricanes, for example. So there may be, you know, some issues that we run up against in spending 30-50% more in order to build hurricane-proof buildings, but in the long haul, it's, I think, to the benefit of the agency and the people of Texas.
Thank you for an excellent report.
Thanks, guys.
Moving along, I'm going to offer a slight change in our procedure here. Agenda items 7, 8, 9, and 13 will also be presented during the commission meeting tomorrow. And in light of our time, I'm going to let those items be presented then. Moving now to agenda item number
10.
10.
Yeah,
10. Granting of utility easement, Telepinto County Public Waterline, Possum Kingdom State Park, Mr. Ted Hollingsworth.
Chairman, commissioners, good evening. My name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. This item pertains to the granting of utility easement at Possum Kingdom State Park. Staff of the agency have been working with the Possum Kingdom Utility Board for several years now to try and bring a public water source into the park. Currently we have our own water treatment facilities and wastewater treatment facilities in the park, and to the extent that we can get onto a public system, it's easier on us for management and operations and so forth. This just gives you an idea of where Possum Kingdom State Park is in relationship to the city of Fort Worth and a couple of other facilities we have locally. The line actually passes under the lake, comes up inside the park, passes through the park, and then would service currently about 100 downstream customers, which is the reason we're coming to you to advise you that that we're negotiating an easement. The plan, the engineering plan, has developed very quickly. Staff is still in negotiation to try and minimize impacts inside the park. For example, we're not convinced that the pump station and a water tower need to be inside the park itself. So staff is currently developing, is currently working with the engineers to try and minimize those impacts to the park. Again, as I mentioned, the new facilities will replace off-site water facilities and reduce our operating costs and operating exposure. And possibly more importantly, we'll bring the park into compliance with Texas Commission Environmental Quality. We've been out of compliance for several years. TCEQ has been forbearing as we've kind of taken some liberties with the fact that our water isn't always up to standards. And since our downstream customers, we're also negotiating water rates. We are facilitating the delivery of water to downstream customers by allowing the line to come through the park as we're currently working with them. This is the motion that you'll see tomorrow. The executive director is authorized to take all necessary steps to negotiate terms and conditions for the granting of an easement to Possum Kingdom Water Supply Corporation to result in the delivery of water to Possum Kingdom State Park. And I'll be happy to answer any questions you have.
Any questions or comments for Ted? Hearing none, I will place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Committee item number 11, land acquisition, Angelina County, 486 acres as an addition to the Alizan Bayou Wildlife Management Area. Request permission to begin the public notice and input process. Mr. Corky Coleman, please.
Commissioners, for the record, my name is Corky Coleman with the Land Conservation Program. Good evening. This is in Angelina County, in addition to the Alizan Bayou Wildlife Management Area. This area is about halfway between Lufkin and Nacogdoches, Texas. As you can see in this map, the 486 acres is the track we're talking about. It isn't adjacent to the Alizan Bayou, but there are conservation lands in between this track and Alizan Bayou and will be managed out of that unit. The track in between the Stephen F. Austin Experimental Forest is used for educational and recreational purposes. The track, as you can see, has about 3.5 miles of Angelina River, has two boat ramps on it. That's just another relationship between the two tracks. It's all hardwood bottom. Our purchase of this track would prevent this bottom from fragmentation by agriculture use or splitting up the tracks into smaller tracks for resale. Like I mentioned, 3.3 miles of Angelina River with two boat ramps provide for some excellent recreation as well as in addition to the WMA. All we're asking is for permission to negotiate with the willing sellers, contact for an appraisal, and come back to you at a future commission meeting for action on this item. Would that answer any questions?
Any questions or discussion for Corky on this item? Hearing none, I will ask staff to begin public notice and input process. Next item, committee item number 12, land acquisition, Cameron County, 25.30 acres from the Valley Land Fund, Inc., as an addition to the Loyal Colorado Wildlife Management Area.
Again, for the record, Corky Coleman. This is the first time you're going to see this item. We're going to do this as a one commission item acquisition. It's kind of a cleanup item. We had asked the Valley Land Fund to purchase this tract, which as you can see is northeast of Harlingen, and it is actually an in-hauling of Oregon, Colorado, WMA. You can see it there. We'd asked them to purchase this tract. They did so about 3 years ago. We didn't have the acquisition authority or the funds to purchase it then. We do now, and we promised them we would take it out at our earliest convenience. It's going to help protect valuable and dwindling habitat in the Rio Grande Valley. And like I said, we had promised the Valley Land Fund we would take them out at our earliest convenience. So it's a motion that will be before you. The executive director is authorized to take all necessary steps to acquire the 25.3 acre tract as an addition to the Loyal Colorado Wildlife Management Area.
Any discussion or questions for Corky on this item? Hearing none, I'll place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. As mentioned before, agenda item number 13 will be deferred for the Commission meeting tomorrow. We now go to agenda item number 14, update on possible land acquisition and development in Palo Pinto County. This item was discussed in executive session. There is no further action required. And then we have item number 15, pending litigation. Update on land taking, Cameron County, border fence through, we can't say that right, an aqua unit as at Las Palomas Wildlife Management Area. This item was also discussed in executive session, and no further action is required at this time. Mr. Chairman, this committee has now completed its business.
Appreciate it, sir. We go to infrastructure with Commissioner John Barber.
Are we ready?
Feel good.
First order of business is the approval of the minutes from the previous committee meeting, which is have already been distributed. Is there a motion for approval?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor say
aye.
Committee item number one, update on Texas Parks and Wildlife Department progress in implementing the TPWD Land and Water Resources Conservation Recreation Plan. Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate it. I guess just two items very, very quickly. I think as all of you are aware, in late summer, the Legislative Budget Board approved the suite of major capital repair projects that we had put forth for authorization. The infrastructure team has bundled about two-thirds of those into large geographic packages to comport with our three infrastructure divisions. We put those out for bid for the design phase. The design consultants have been selected for each one of those, and that is moving ahead. We have since followed up with putting those out for bid for the construction managers who would manage the construction manager at risk contracts for each one of those packages. And while we had a very large attendance and interest at the pre-bid conference for that, ultimately we only ended up getting four bids for those three packages. And so our team is doing the due diligence on those firms right now and hopes to be making a decision on that so we can move ahead post-haste with those critical important repairs. I see our old friend Steve Whiston out there in the audience. Steve, nice to see you again. And reminds me of the second item, which is we have to find a successor for Steve Whiston. And so Scott Borup is working with our executive recruiter to recruit a new director of infrastructure. I think they're going to be conducting interviews in the next 2 weeks, and so hope to have somebody on board around Thanksgiving, or at least somebody selected around Thanksgiving or certainly before Christmas. So glad that process is underway and more to report on that as it develops. So, Mr. Chairman, that's it for me. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Now we'll have an update on the status of our Texas Parks and Wildlife capital program and capital projects, various state parks. I would like to introduce you to Mr. Scott Stover, who is working in infrastructure now. Scott.
I just want to take a moment, folks, number one, to just make sure the record is clear. We did get four responses to proposals. We put out requests for proposals for the construction of the packages, and we got four construction outbids that responded to the request. We had yet to get bids from them. We are currently doing our due diligence to see whether their qualifications meet or not, so I just want to make sure the record is clear on that. And then the reason I came up here, for the record, my name is Scott Warf, and I'm still employed the same way I was earlier. The Steve Whiston, as you may know, retired about a month and a half ago. Prior to Steve coming on, back in May, we went out and looked for a deputy division director. We were fortunate to find Mr. Scott Stover, and I thought I'd take just a minute to introduce Scott to you here before he takes his first bite of the apple in front of the commission. Scott came from San Antonio. He's a licensed landscape architect. He was with the city of San Antonio for 14 years there as their capital project manager for lots of capital projects. In 14 years, he got 14 awards there for design and construction innovation. So I guess about once a year he's taking down an award. I hope he keeps that up with us. Most notably, he was responsible for a $7 million renovation to the San Pedro Springs Park, which is the second oldest public park in the country. And prior to his work with the city of San Antonio, he was in the private sector for 13 years. So Scott has a lot of experience. We're really lucky to have him on board. He's been with us since May as a deputy director, and since Mr. Whiston's departure 6 or 8 weeks ago, he's been the acting division director for the infrastructure division. So we'd like to welcome you here, Scott, and look forward to your presentation.
Thank you. Thank you, Scott. I wanted to start off and give you kind of an update. Usually you get an update on programs and specific projects, but I thought I would start off and just kind of show you what overall the division is doing and what projects we're working on. As far as workload, we currently are overseeing about 202 projects, $121 million worth of work, not including the battleship because we don't have the funds for that yet, but kind of gives you in perspective the amount of projects that the agency is currently overseeing. The 06 bonds, we've been giving you updates on those at every meeting because if we're coming close to the end where we need to expend those funds, we have completed a few more projects since the last meeting, and we are still on schedule for completing the last 24 projects by September of next year. So those are on schedule. The 0809, as Carter and Scott alluded to, we are well on our way with selection of design firms for the three packages. We are also on our way for the construction contracts as well, and as far as since your last meeting in September, the bond proceeds became available. In October, we received 23 responses to the A&E packages. We reviewed those, selected the three firms which we're negotiating with, and should have contracts for those this month. We also received the CMR construction packages as well. We hope to have those under contract by January.
Be sure you explain what these acronyms are.
Yes. Construction manager at risk are the construction firms that we will hire on early on. They will work with our consultants during the design process to help get a better design for the projects, recommend materials that maybe they know some things that the A&E firms don't know as far as what may be priced lower or higher in certain instances, but they become part of the design team, just as the AE and just as our staff, so that everybody works as a team early on in the project. We don't wait to bid the project towards the end, but they become part of the team early on. But we're looking at awarding those contracts in January, starting construction on some of the in-house projects. We've started six of those projects already with our in-house force account crew. Projects under the CMR contractor will be later on, beginning probably next summer. Construction completed starting in November of 2010 through November of 2011, and our program completion by November of 2011. This map shows the distribution of the projects in the 08-09 packages, and they're pretty much spread out throughout the whole state. The different colors represent the three regions or the three packages that those projects are divided up into. I want to go into now some of the specific projects, some of the major ones that we're currently working on. Texas Game Warden Academy Phase 1. Just this week we signed our guaranteed maximum price with the contractor for $7.5 million out of our $9.4 million budget. CMR proposal was received. He should start work by the end of this month on mobilizing on site and getting work ready. And Phase 1 construction will be completed by December of next year. Battleship Texas, as you heard at the last meeting, we did submit our plan to the LBB in July. We're waiting for approval of that plan so we can proceed to seek the funding. We hope to have that by November 24th so we can meet the Texas Public Finance Authority meeting in December, followed by the Bond Review Board in January, and then receiving those funds sometime in early February. Taking that into account, we'll start the request to hire a consultant in November of this year, actually this month, start the design and a federal resource clearance, which is environmental, archaeological, historical type aspects, to begin all that work in March of next year, completing that in April of 2011, starting construction that summer, and completed a year later in 2012.
I'd like to interject here. That schedule is ambitious and subject to some significant risk for lots of different factors. I'm not going to keep you here long talking about it. I just want you to know this is what we hope would happen. There is some risk the schedule will be delayed for lots of reasons. One thing, we haven't gotten the authority to issue the bonds, and we don't know that that will happen by November the 24th, which is rapidly approaching. We don't get the bonds until November the 24th. We're going to miss that cycle. It would allow us to issue those bonds early next year. So that's the first big risk. Second big risk is this is a unique project that takes unique resources that are not readily available around the country. And the third is there is a debate out there about whether the ship should stay where it is or go somewhere else or whatever. So there is the schedules are fixed. Just want to make sure they understand.
East Texas Fish Hatchery started construction this summer. There was a groundbreaking in August, which many of you attended, including Commissioner Parker. We expect to have that construction completed in summer of 2010. Since July, they finished about 20% of the site work for the buildings and for the ponds, and over 50% of the utility work to service those buildings and ponds have been completed as well. A new project that we've not reported on before is the new headquarters for coastal fisheries at Port O'Connor. They're currently in an old building that's kind of a World War II era facility. They've kind of outgrown those needs. This new building will be an 8,500 square foot, two-story building, which will be LEED, meeting LEED standards or green building standards, but it will not be certified. It has a $2.1 million budget overall. Design's 50% complete. Construction starting next spring and finished in the summer of 2010. Last single project I'd like to report on is the Sheldon Lake Observation Tower. It's a 60-foot observation tower within the park. We're having a design charrette with the architects this week to start the design work on that. And the tower will be accessible to people in wheelchairs. There will be an elevator in it. And we'll be using green building techniques to design and build that tower, including managed harvested wood for the lumber, solar power for the electrical systems, and using oil field piping reused for some of the structural components. That project will finish design in March, construction start in July, and construction complete in February of 2010. At the same site, there's a related project, Sheldon Visitor Learning Center. We're partnering with the Audubon Society on that project. Their board of directors approved last month to commit to raise $7.5 million to build this visitor learning center. And we're working on a contract with them now, which we hope to bring to the board in the January meeting. We're going to be using the new Trinity Center, their Audubon Center up in Dallas, as a model for this project, and there'll be a team of our staff going up next week to take a tour of that facility and see what that building was built like and what features are in that facility. And that's the conclusion of the presentation. Be happy to answer any questions.
Any discussion? We'll get you out of here 5 minutes before five. Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you. You're a lot better. Thank you.
That's what they're asking me for.
I think we're declared adjourned.